Welcome to the Health Edge, translating the science of self-care. I am Mark Pettis, and glad you have tuned in to the Health Edge. Appreciate your taking time out of your busy, hectic life to allow some undivided attention around some healthcare themes, news to use, and usually joined by Dr. John Bagnulo, an extraordinary naturalist, nutritional scientist, and John is still transitioning his family up in Middlebury, Vermont, and he will soon join the wired world as he works on establishing a new home front. And once he is back online, he will be joining me. So thank you for tuning in. This is a follow-up podcast on a topic of inflammation, which we had part one a few weeks back and looked at 10 of the more common causes of inflammation and emphasized the fact that inflammation as a imbalance or disruption of one's immune response that tends to overreact to certain triggers in one's environment or changes of alignment in one's environment with respect to what the immune system is accustomed to being in relationship with will result in an over-exaggerated response, one that, depending on the nature of the triggers, is frequently a chronic response. And the suppressor side of the immune system, all our biologic systems are inherently balanced. That which would normally reel in a hypervigilant response is also disrupted. So that regulatory mechanism of recognizing the need to put the brakes on is impaired. So this, as we reviewed, affects human biology in a very significant way. And most chronic complex diseases, obesity, diabetes, hypertension, metabolic syndrome, cancer, heart disease, stroke, dementia like Alzheimer's, autoimmunity, increasingly has strong connections to these altered inflammatory pathways. And so we're going to look at some what I would consider to be low-hanging fruit. All of these topics, in some respect, have been reviewed in other podcasts. So feel free, if you're new to the Health Edge, to look at the library, what is archived, that John and I have done, if you're interested in delving into more detail. So I would emphasize that from a lifestyle perspective, there are tremendous opportunities here, and often in a very short time, in a matter of weeks, 2 to 4 weeks, one can begin to experience significant change in how they feel. And the quicker one begins to experience change, the more likely one is to continue to engage in behaviors that can maintain that change and even take it to another level. So these are not things that generally take a long time to have impact. A big challenge for so many is perhaps finding a physician or caregiver, nurse practitioner, caregiver, clinical psychologist who has some background in integrative and functional medical models. These are not always easy to find. I often recommend the Institute for Functional Medicine. The Institute for Functional Medicine, on their homepage, there is a Find a Practitioner link, and they update practitioners that have done various aspects of their training. And as you are prompted for your zip code, you can find somebody who may be in your area. And you'll see these are people from all disciplines that in some way can inform a lens that can be very, very helpful. It's also very helpful to be working with a dietitian that has some knowledge and integrative approaches, someone who's willing to step outside, in some instances anyway, mainstream thinking and looking at individual needs and how those needs can be met in ways that guidelines sometimes only take us so far to support others. So again, not always easy to find practitioners that are a bit more, you know, I hate to use the word outside the box because this is all very much evidence-based, but these things just take some time to work into mainstream thinking. So there can be some homework involved. If you have friends that have worked with practitioners and have had really effective engagement, definitely get advice from them as to who you can be partnering with. And hopefully you can get some help. But a lot of this work really does take sort of getting onto websites. And there are a lot of great sites out there now trying to empower yourself as much as you can. And when there's controversy, as there so often is, understanding there is no one right or wrong way, try a few different things. Give yourself this N of one test and see how you respond. And what works for you may be a little bit different than what perhaps worked for a friend or what you might be reading about. But once you generally get some principles, I think you can leverage a lot of opportunity. And this is really, really powerful stuff. So we looked at, and I'm going to briefly go through these causes, and then we'll tie them to some what I would view as some really important lifestyle opportunities. One of the single greatest causes of inflammation is when we store fat around the midsection, what we call visceral fat. And again, for any woman with a waist size of 35 inches or greater, or for a man 40 inches or greater, maybe even less, but those are sort of the current standards. Inflammation is likely being triggered. And so the ticket there, and a lot of what I'm going to be touching on is nutritional. The ticket there, as is true for so many other mediators of inflammation, is to, again, try to diminish as much processed food as you can, particularly those foods that contain a lot of sugar or refined flour, grain-based food, carbohydrate-dense foods that tend to be broken down quickly into simple sugars that get not only absorbed in our small intestine and can really disrupt insulin, which is a major hormonal player for all aspects of inflammation and the many chronic complex diseases that come from it. And they also alter the human microbiome, as we are getting more evidence around, that upregulates or promotes a more inflammatory response. And even the fiber that you find in many of these grains, you know, bran fiber, they can be pro-inflammatory in that they're insoluble sources of fiber. The bacteria in our gut tend to handle them a bit differently than fiber that's coming from plant-based foods. Cutting back on carbohydrates of simple sugar, flour, grain-based forms, in my view, is one of the single most effective ways that you can begin to diminish fat storage around the midsection. Adding to that, as we talked about in many podcasts, John and I, becoming more comfortable with fat sources that perhaps you have been thinking were not good for you. And these are healthier fat sources that would include butter, that would include, if you're okay with dairy, full fat dairy, particularly fermented dairy, yogurts, cheeses, particularly the hard cheeses, eggs, with emphasis on the yolks. And again, you know, pasture raised is always better than conventional sources for these animal products. If you eat animal products, and I know a lot of listeners may be vegan or vegetarian, but the grain, I think, is an important target there if you're struggling with inflammation. Other good fat sources in terms of extra virgin olive oil, coconut oil, would be fatty fish, you know, salmon, mackerel, sardines, anchovies, trout. And again, fish is a particularly fatty fish is a really good source of omega-3s. We know that grass-fed meats and the fats that they contain are probably not as bad for us as people often think. And I would encourage you to look at the podcast John and I have done with respect to red meats. I think a lot of it is sourcing, and the fats that accompany that healthy sourcing, I think, are good for people. Generations ago, we saw a lot of use of lard, tallow, and again, from decent sources. These allow one to be satiated with less carbohydrate, and there's no insulin or insulinogenic response, and fat profiling by lowering the omega-6 processed seed vegetable oils that John and I often talk about, particularly oils that tend to be cooked at very high temperature, consuming less of those and eating more of these healthy sources of fat can be a very, very important macronutrient and quality shift that can totally begin to melt away fat around the midsection, alter the microbiome in a more positive way, and in doing so, bring into control these root triggers for inflammatory responses. Avocado is another really great source of fat. So this can take some time. I always will ask a question when I'm working with clients, and I work with a lot of clients who have very limited resources and lots of stressors and struggling in their lives. But often I'll ask them, as you look at your life, what is the one thing, perhaps more than any, that you think you can do that can change whatever it is, fill in the blank, what you wish to change? It might be weight, it might be depression, it might be pain, it might be energy, it might be sleep. Most people have a sense of some things that they can do, and anything incrementally in this category will be very, very helpful. We talk a lot about fermentable fiber, the what we call the MAX, M-A-C, the microbiota accessible carbohydrate. These are plant-based fibers that tend to be more soluble in the cruciferous vegetable family. Broccoli, cauliflower, collards, cabbage. The brassica family is loaded with nutrient-dense foods that can help prevent, you know, cancer, help us detoxify. They're very good at lowering inflammatory pathways, and they can be really good sources of fiber. The allium family, onions, you know, leeks. I think some legumes, you know, can be very, very great sources of fiber. Resistant starches, like you might find in a cooled potato or white rice that has been cooked and then cooled. Plantains, good source of resistant starch. So making more conscious attempts to include more of these MAX in your diet will dramatically begin to alter the microbiome, the diversity of organisms in your gut, which we know can dramatically downregulate or help control. They text message our immune system, and the metabolic byproducts they produce, these short-chain fatty acids like butyrate, are known to lower inflammation on an epigenetic level, altering how our genes express themselves, altering directly how our immune system responds, and the literature and the science continues to grow in a really interesting way. And this is another aspect of diet that perhaps is, when you add that to bringing in less good quality carbohydrates, introducing healthier fat sources, and introducing more microbiota accessible carbohydrates, fermentable plant-based fiber in your diet, you will be definitely off to the races in terms of significant changes with visceral fat and controlling inflammation by factors beyond just that which fat contributes to around the midsection. Yeah, we know that nutrient-dense foods, particularly plant-based foods, have many anti-inflammatory, we call them polyphenols. And you don't see these on the labels. There's nothing that points to polyphenols. And we know that colorful fruits, vegetables. On the fruit side, definitely if you're dealing with visceral fat, you need to be careful with the higher glycemic and the fructose containing fruits. So generally, I would steer people away from grapes and bananas and maybe even apples and focus more on berries, blueberries, strawberries, raspberries, kiwi, grapefruit. These can be really good sources of fruit with lower fructose and glycemic effects. And if you're trying to lose weight, not all fruits are good for you. And if you have insulin resistance, which is a major cause of inflammation, and it goes along with this belly fat, then I would be more cautious about some fruits. We combine fruits and vegetables in our language, in our vernacular. They're not equal, and particularly with respect to those sugar and fructose components. So those are really important high-level nutritional principles that I think can help anyone dealing with visceral fat, dealing with alterations of their microbiome, this dysbiosis, and getting more nutrient-dense foods that so many people just do not get sufficient amounts of that are anti-inflammatory in their diets. The topics of genetic modification, and again, John and I have had some specific podcasts around this, but I do think I steer people without hesitation toward certified organic foods. GMO labeling isn't always accurate, but I would just be reminding folks that genetic modification is really more about the glyphosate Roundup that John and I have talked about, that we know and are just at the tip of the iceberg here, can alter the human microbiome, can promote inflammatory pathways, interferes with what we call the Shikmate pathway in bacteria, which produces amino acids, tyrosine and tryptophan that we need for serotonin and melatonin and dopamine, brain function. So, these are while many would say the evidence is not sufficient, lack of evidence is not does not in any way imply there isn't a risk. And so this is yet another layer that one can look at if they're trying to lower inflammatory food sources. So organic is definitely the way to go if and when you can afford it. And I know many people can't. So, an apple's always better than a bagel or a bag of chips. I think it you've got to always look at things on a relative scale. Stress, we know, is a major cause of inflammation and chronic stress, stress that is day in and day out, that leaves people really feeling overwhelmed, feeling out of control, feeling trapped. When an individual begins to perceive that they are trapped in a set of conditions from which they have no escape, financial, employment, workplace, dealing with many stressors in life, maybe an addicted child or family member, dealing with a child with special needs that maybe poses certain challenges, dealing with caregiving for so many loved ones that ultimately need more help with dementia or with Parkinson's or with other health-related issues. We all confront unique and profound and chronic stresses in our lives. And though our response to that is often a labor of love, chronic stress will overwhelm this hypothalamic pituitary fight-flight axis. And in doing so, our immune systems are just placed on overdrive. And while we can't control conditions in our lives that stress us out, what we do have some influence over is our interpretation and response to those conditions. And so much of the mindfulness work that is known to reduce, on an epigenetic level, gene translation of inflammatory paths, mindfulness and mind-body exercises that we know can lower or bring into more balance this hypothalamic pituitary axis by activating this parasympathetic nervous system that one can control on some level and to varying degrees the biologic interpretation and response to those conditions in our lives. So I do a simple breath exercise with a lot of clients I'm working with. I have them close their eyes. I have them bring their attention to their breath, and I'll have them inhale through their mouth to a count of five. I will have them hold it for a count of five. And then I'll have them exhale, if comfortable, through their mouth to a count of five, six. And then you just repeat that for a minute or two. And often as their eyes are closed, I'll ask them to think about, in their mind's eye, picture someone or something that they love so profoundly. Someone that means the world to them. And as they slow and deepen their breaths and bring into their mind's eye the image of someone that is so loving and someone that they just feel so happy about and contented with, in a moment, 30 seconds to a minute, to a couple of minutes, you will begin to see a total recalibration of this fight-flight system. Sometimes finding another way to interpret and respond to conditions in our lives can bring us to some very challenging decisions. Some of them may be nutritional decisions, because many of the foods that one would like to reduce can actually activate a fight-flight response. It may require re-examining a relationship that's just maybe too toxic and not working. And sometimes we need help breaking from those relationships. It may be getting help, cognitive behavioral therapy, working with a clinical psychologist and trying to find different ways and different strategies for interpreting and responding to stress. Is there a different way that you can examine these conditions? And it's not about being good or being bad or being right or being wrong. It's about trying to cultivate a response that will serve you better than you're currently being served. Because we have thoughts, and we have lots of thoughts, but we are not our thoughts. We have feelings, many complex emotions, and we are not our emotions. We, spiritually, I believe, have the capacity to cultivate a spiritual response that can allow us to experience those thoughts and experience those feelings and yet not be controlled by them. And not to suggest that that's easy by any means. Many people have been traumatized in their lives. They've served in wars. They've been victims of violence, sexual abuse. Our brains are designed in ways that make it really, really difficult to respond differently when we experience those things in our lives. So these are things that we need help with, sometimes very significant and long-term help. But anything we can do, and sometimes being bold, changing jobs, changing relationships, these are things that can sometimes bring us to places that we never imagined, we could find in our lives. Very important for lowering inflammation. We talk about sedentary states, and so motion is the lotion. And again, there's no rocket science here, but generally, when people do start eating better and working on their stress, they will often have much more energy, and so movement begins to happen more spontaneously. People do begin to feel more motivation. Motivation is more a biologic state than it is this ethereal state that you're lucky enough to either have or don't have. So walking, I just tell folks, walk as much as you can and do it outdoors as much as you can. If you're able to, couple days a week, 20, 30 minutes, do something a bit more intensive from a cardio perspective, cycle it, this interval, become breathless. That will give you more return on the investment of time and effort. And then, resistance working on core, from push-ups to squats to lunges, you know, very simple core exercises, resistance exercises to work on muscle mass is so important and has significant anti-inflammatory responses, helps with the stress response, helps lower insulin levels, helps reduce inflammation. All of these things that I'm talking about work through very similar mechanisms, and they're synergistic. So it's not like 1 + 1 + 1 = 3. 1 + 1 = 5 + 1 = 10 + 1 = 20. You get this accelerated traction when you begin to combine these and continue to allow them to evolve. Again, these are behavior is largely biologically and emotionally driven. So once one begins to bring some balance to that dimension of one's life, the behaviors and the biology shifts in a way that tend to be a bit more spontaneous, and they're not perceived as requiring quite as much effort. And that's the holy grail to cultivate and sustain more movement. Disrupted sleep, and again, all of these are long, complicated topics, and we have separate podcasts on them. But disrupted sleep is another one of the core lifestyle contributors to inflammation. When you are not sleeping well, your immune system thinks there are problems in your neck of the woods, and it will be hypervigilant, it will overreact. And we know that disrupted sleep worsens the risk of depression, worsens the risk of obesity, worsens the risk of autoimmunity, worsens the risk of insulin resistance, worsens the risk of cardiovascular disease. The reason it worsens the risk of all of those things is because disrupted sleep patterns ultimately promote an inflammatory response. And since inflammation is linked to all those things, we are now recognizing epidemiologically and through a lot of experimental research that we need to recognize the importance of sleep, and we need to develop some very basic sleep hygiene patterns, because like so much of what John and I talk about, our environment, our modern environment is loaded with lights of poor quality, junk light. We have all this hubbub beyond our normal sun up, sundown, circadian rhythms that are still alive and well. This chronobiology, we have chronogenes, we have chronobiology, we have tightly regulated evolutionary, biologic, adaptive patterns that are in sync with a very different rhythm than what most of us experience in our modern lives. And so these are all disruptive to our sleep patterns. And we all have a different chronobiologic rhythm. You know, some of us are early birds. Some of us are night owls. Some of us have sort of chronic insomnia. We have different sleep drives. Some of us need more sleep than others. But we know that sleep, regardless of one's individual circumstances, is a major anti-inflammatory dimension of our lives. And so sleep hygiene would take the form of very dark rooms. I mean very dark, good shades, nothing coming through them, unplugging any device that is lit, trying to minimize late night use of one's laptop or smartphone or computer. And if you do use them, there are ways that you can control the lighting, the magnitude of the lighting. You know, warmer light temperatures tend to be this, you know, this hot blue. Blue is stimulating. It will diminish and inhibit melatonin. That's really good light earlier in the day, but not later at night. So you can change the color temperature of your devices to give them a cooler temperature, less intense blue light. There are filters and applications, F.Lux, L-U-X. Apple now has a built-in app for their devices that will automatically synchronize with your time zone and filter out some of that blue light later in the day. This is really important. Most compact fluorescent lighting is junk-like. It has a lot of blue light. It has a light pattern of mercury. It may be energy efficient, but it's really not good for circadian rhythm and for health in general, in my humble objective opinion. So I recommend incandescent lights when you can find them. At bedtime or during the evening, if you have an amber or a red light, incandescent light, that will give you a more biologically appropriate lit environment for the messengers in your brain that should be activated and not suppressed. Applying simple meditation techniques can be very, very helpful. We talked about the stress reduction, breathing exercises, soothing sounds. I use heart rate variability, the HeartMath company, heartmath.com. These are biofeedback stress-reducing exercises. I have no financial interest in any company. It's just a really good tool, good evidence, and it's very cool if you like the technology. These can help before bedtime. Getting more quality full-spectrum light earlier in the day is also critical to calibrating one's chronobiology. So particularly over the fall, winter seasons, depending on where you live, the further away from the equator you are, if you can introduce full spectrum lighting, a light box, getting 20 to 30 minutes of that in the morning will be very, very helpful in synchronizing your chronobiologic systems. If you can get out during the day as much as you can, just to be out in full spectrum light. We have nature deficit disorder. We have full spectrum light deficiency. We have junk light excess in our lives. These are major contributors to disruptive sleep patterns. And, there's no question that some simple sleep hygiene and trying some of these tools can very much help an individual reestablish some of that balance and lower their inflammation. Some people may have obstructive sleep apnea. If you have a neck circumference of greater than 16 and a half inches as a woman, 17 inches as a man, if your significant other says you snore a lot, or they observe you even not breathing for a matter of seconds during the night, if you're often waking up and not feeling restored and rested, you may have obstructive sleep apnea. That's a very important diagnosis to be aware of, because ultimately CPAP can help you, until which time perhaps losing more of that visceral fat can allow you to wean off of that. But that's a very important and correctable form of disrupted sleep. So those are some basic sleep hacks. There are a lot of herbs that can be helpful, from melatonin in often very low doses, a half a milligram up to 3 milligrams, to L-theanine, T-H-E-A-N-I-N-E, 200 to 400 milligrams at bedtime. Chamomile, passion flower, teas are really soothing and very nice. Things like glycine in low doses, an amino acid, can be sedating, 500 to 1,000 milligrams. Those are just some botanicals that might be worth thinking about that, for the most part, are relatively safe. And in addition to other lifestyle measures, can improve sleep hygiene and very much begin to reduce inflammatory triggers. We know that there are many environmental toxins that we confront. And again, these are huge topics. But so much research now is consistent with the fact that our burden of environmental toxin exposure in modern times will disrupt our immune systems. Our immune systems are often faked by these compounds into thinking, a threat is imminent. And these are threats. And while they may not be imminent threats, this is poor health by a thousand cuts, inflammation by a thousand cuts. You don't feel each one when it's happening. So this is under the iceberg, beneath the surface. We know that pesticides and herbicides, organic, especially for the Dirty Dozen, the Environmental Working Group, EWG.org, is a really good way to lower your burden of pesticide exposure. If you can afford organic, that's definitely the way to go for the Dirty Dozen. Introducing more of the Clean 15. These are also good fermentable fiber sources. Things like we talked about GMO and certified organic is the best way to be assured that you're not getting genetic modified foods. And again, the issue there is very much the glyphosate. Many grains where glyphosate is used for browning. So even organic oats, wheat sources, barley will get sprayed with glyphosate to create browning in the field so they can be harvested quickly, diminish the storage time, help them beat what might be inclement weather coming, all of which can create mold issues. And so browning has become a popular way to efficiently drive agricultural production and yield. Many foods just have a lot of this glyphosate. And John and I have talked about if you can minimize your exposure to that, you're better off, no question. The same is true for other industrialized food production, feedlot chicken, feedlot beef, these concentrated, these are just horrible for the planet, for the animals, and for the people that consume foods from these origins. We know that there are many cosmetics, and again, I frequently refer to EWG.org. Skin Deep is a really good database for looking at hygiene products. And again, just trying to, you might select one, find a different shampoo, find a different conditioner, find a different moisturizer, maybe a different sunscreen. Try to target one simple change and see how that works. Mold, if you live in water-damaged homes or work in water-damaged environments, mold could be a big issue as an environmental exposure. That's a complicated thing but with the right doc, you can come to the right diagnosis, to the right remediation, and there are many lifestyle strategies and protocols to help individuals detoxify to eliminate their burden of exposure. And again, all of the dietary things that I've talked about hold equally well for enhancing detoxification pathways. We know that heavy metals and dealing with mouth issues from amalgams, old root canals, another frequent source of inflammation. And again, the dental world still considers these standards of care. And I think we don't know what we don't know. And what we do know is that for many people who've had amalgams, root canals for long periods of time, these inevitably begin to create either heavy metal or occult chronic inflammatory triggers 24/7. So again, this can take some time to sort out and to deal with, but they're very good supplement, nutritional detoxification strategies, chelation strategies that can help people navigate these. Another really important dimension to inflammation. The gut, and there's just so much out there now about the gut in terms of leakiness, leaky gut, gut barrier dysfunction. Elimination trials, again, focusing really on gluten and perhaps grains in general, sugar, fructose, maybe casein sources can be really important. 30, 60-day elimination trials can greatly bring some balance to any potential food sensitivity that's triggering a gut issue, an inflammatory issue. The dysbiosis, and again, bringing in more fermentable plant-based microbiota-accessible carbohydrates, SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and finding a practitioner that can test for that. Breath testing can be very, very helpful in finding strategies to eliminate those organisms. And these are antimicrobial strategies. More potent probiotics like VSL number 3, just one that I like and has been tested, can be very, very important. Digestive enzymes for people that maybe have been on a proton pump inhibitor, these acid blockers for a long time. That promotes not only dysbiosis, but it interferes with our ability to break down food, which requires a more acidic environment. So digestive enzymes with each meal can be an important way to help better digestion and breakdown and assimilation of nutrients. The gut, is an important source of inflammation. What happens in the gut doesn't stay in the gut. And so these are all strategies that are very, very important. And again, I would encourage you to check in with some of our other podcasts that will dramatically lower inflammation and all that comes with it. We talked about light, and again, light deprivation syndrome is really important. So getting really good full spectrum light, sunlight, and particularly in those early morning hours, light box for times of the year, you want to get 10,000 lux. If it's a vitamin D producing light box, you'll pay a little bit more, but it'll be worth it. You'll get the UVB light and you'll be able to make some vitamin D. Vitamin D is a major player in bringing balance to our immune response. And most chronic complex diseases with a strong inflammatory component are associated epidemiologically with low vitamin D levels. And while I do think vitamin D supplementation, particularly over the poor sun quality months, is important, and I do recommend blood levels and try to recommend people get their levels between 30 and, say, 60. There's a sweet spot for everything. But if you can get your vitamin D from full-spectrum light exposure, UVB exposure, I say get all that you can. You don't want a sunburn, but I would take full advantage of quality sun exposure you have. Get out as much as you can for at least 30 minutes to an hour of unprotected exposure. That's very anti-inflammatory. The UVB will also, and the infrared part of the light spectrum, the more orange, near infrared, and infrared wavelengths of sunlight are powerfully detoxifying. They also help mitochondrial function. Light is medicine, and we are, I think, guiding people in ways that, and I don't mean to sound judgmental, but you know, skin cancer, while a legitimate issue, should not have us fearful of the sun. And most of us need more exposure than we're getting. Very anti-inflammatory, and again, very health promoting. And then lastly, I want to end this podcast on the two really important sort of social determinants of loneliness, isolation, lack of social connection. I think these are often epidemic, and we often don't talk about them. In public health circles, they're widely recognized. In population health circles, a lot of the work that I do for Berkshire Health Systems is in Western Massachusetts, highly understands the importance of social connection and love and meaning in the context of loving relationships as an important contributor to overall health and wellness. We know from several studies, some of them sponsored by AARP, a United States organization, of retired people, that as many as 40% of people would consider their lives lonely and disconnected. And surprisingly, it's more common in the younger age group than as people get older. We know that isolation, loneliness, is a stress state. The experience of feeling disconnected, which often goes along with perhaps feeling hopeless and helpless, like a plant that's not getting enough sunlight or water or nutrients, will have activation of their immune response, will have activation of the fight-flight hypothalamic pituitary response. These are pro-inflammatory states. And while there's no one easy way to address this, anytime one can connect with others, if you're listening to this podcast and you know someone who's maybe lonely and disconnected, reach out to them. Give them a call, stop by, knock on their door, write them a note, tell them how much their life means to you. People often, once they connect in other groups, they might be support groups, it might be a faith community, begin to open up. We have many wellness programs in our community. They're all group models. The group model is so important as people connect with each other. And express their love and caring and compassion for each other. Old world views have long known the importance of this. This is an important and I think silent epidemic that very much drives in inflammatory pathways. And again, the extent to which we can be reaching out and helping others, the extent to which maybe an individual dealing with anxiety or depression in the context of maybe looking for group support. Most hospitals, most community hospitals have a community relations department. If you call a hospital, ask for the community relations department, will have listings of support groups in one's community. And there are all kinds of support groups for Alzheimer's, for caregivers, for cancer, depression, for pain. It's just so important that we be together and that we appreciate that ours is a journey meant to be shared. And for many reasons, that is not easily applied in one's life. So that's an overview of many ways that one can begin to think about lowering inflammation in their lives, some of which will have rapid recognition, some of which may take a little more time to recognize. These are things that one can, again, work toward either in small incremental ways. I think largely this is about trying to more effectively manage one's environment, the conditions in one's life. If you have foods that aren't good for you in your cabinets, it'll be hard to resist the temptation, you know, to eat those foods. So one has to really try to control their environment, the foods that are in it, the healthcare products that are in it, the quality of the lighting that is in it. One has to more thoughtfully perhaps consider the workplace environment they're in, the need to sit for shorter periods of time, you know, before standing. That may require a little alarm. Altering the lighting in the office if you have control over that. Getting outside a bit more during a break, during lunchtime. So the extent to which you can manage your environment will make certain health-promoting behaviors more easy. This is a behavioral economic perspective, which I find that science, the social psychology, so important, because this is not, while it helps to be rational, being rational hardly, as we all know, assures a behavior that's going to serve us well. We choose much more emotionally and often mindlessly and subconsciously than we do rationally. And so controlling one's environment, setting up prompts, creating those conditions will make more likely a greater percentage of healthy behaviors. So appreciate your tuning into the Health Edge. We are always adding content to our website, thehealthedgepodcast.com. If this content is of value to you and you feel supportive and want to give us a thumbs up at iTunes, we appreciate that. If you like sharing on social media, neither John and I are particularly aggressive with that. We appreciate your outreach and connecting this information to those you love, those you care about, those perhaps you work with. And it's an honor to be able to serve, and it's an honor to be able to connect with other people and to learn and to grow and to try to bring as much joy, right? Happiness can feel elusive. I've come to appreciate in my own life and in working with others that happiness is not something you find. When you behave in your life and try to create conditions in your life that make others happy, that brings compassion to others, that starts to enter our lives. It's remarkable how that works. And so thanks for listening. And my next podcast will be an interview with Dr. Jim Gordon. Jim is the executive director and founder of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine in Washington, D.C. Jim is a pioneer who has brought mind-body work all over the planet and to many healthcare professionals. And we'll have Jim on next week, and I look forward to sharing that interview with you. In the meantime, if you have any questions, feel free to send them to John and I, and thanks for listening.